Pictures flooding my mind and making my pulse speed up. "You're trying to scare me," I accuse. "Again," I say pointedly, giving him a look that says I don't appreciate this type of humor, certainly not after thinking I was losing my mind. And to show him my displeasure, I open the book, making myself more comfortable on my side of the sofa and ignoring him in favor of the story. Minutes pass, and I can tell he's getting increasingly annoyed with the lack of attention, especially as he keeps brushing his shoulder against mine or bumping his knee into mine. Every time I catch him doing it, he gives me a sheepish smile. He's almost like a lazy cat demanding attention. "Stop that! You're distracting!" I use my teacher voice on him, hoping he will feel duly reprimanded. He doesn't. He only gives me another smile, blatantly fluttering his lashes at me as he scoots closer.
"I won't try to scare you again,"
he murmurs huskily.
"In fact, I'll keep you very, very safe,"
he declares as he clasps his hands around my shoulders.
"I'll be your knight in shining armor. Would you like that, Darcy, darling?"
He speaks low in my ear, his tone a combination of needy playfulness and lethal intensity. I still, as my heart drums in my chest. How is it that he can melt my defenses with only a few words, disarm me with the barest of touches? "I reckon you quite enjoy it when I'm scared," I whisper as I slowly turn towards him.
"Me?"
He shakes his head.
"Never, darling."
"Oh, but you do," I continue, meeting his gaze head on. "Because then I'm at your mercy. Isn't that so?" I don't know where the words come from, but the moment I utter them aloud, I know them to be true. He likes to see me on the edge, too close to the precipice, because then he'll be the one to pull me back to safety. Caleb doesn't deny it. He continues to watch me closely, his eyes boring into me.
"Your emotions are a feast in themselves, but your fear, Darcy, darling,"
he says in a low, even tone. All the while, his gaze is still on mine, holding me captive.
"It would keep me sated for an eternity."
"Why?" I whisper.
"Because it's so intimately linked with your desire, with everything that still holds you back,"
he says as he brushes the back of his hand against my cheek. I swallow hard, unable to look away from him. In a way, he is right. About everything. I am afraid. Just as I am uptight, I am all that because something within me keeps me from fully letting go, and I still do not know what. "You would make quite the psychoanalyst," I note with a dry, awkward laugh. His eyes flicker with awareness as he recognizes he touched a sore spot. Slowly he pulls back, letting his lips curl up into a comforting smile. And instead of a sarcastic reply, he promptly switches the topic. Still holding my hand in his, he opens his book, a collection of plays by Bernard Shaw, and starts reading one of them to me. Soon, his voice lulls me into a state of total comfort, despite the previous uneasy conversation. It's just another facet of Caleb that fascinates me. He can read my mood so well, he knows exactly how to react each time. He knows when to tease and when to pull back, when to challenge me and when to soothe me. Every now and then, he pauses to recount an anecdote, telling me a humorous historical tale, or tell me the origin of a certain term used by Shaw. I listen raptly, his intelligence more than matching his outer looks. His words are carefully chosen, his oratorical skills unmatched as he becomes the center of my attention, of my very world. Not for the first time, I have to wonder why he's wasting his time in Fairydale when he could embark on any career he could wish for. He could become a lawyer or a politician. He could do anything he wished. Yet he stayed here, in a small town with no prospects and nothing to recommend it except some errant ghosts. I know he has his business and he makes great money with his work, yet I can't help but wonder if he's truly fulfilled by what he does. He's such a passionate man, a fire burning deep inside of him that he attempts to stifle at every run. I cannot comprehend how or why he limits himself. As he embarks on a history lesson, my interest is piqued as I draw closer to him, almost as if by being glued to his side I could absorb all his knowledge and everything that he is, awe-striking and inspiring. Damn, but he doesn't even need his looks to seduce me. He can do it by merely speaking so articulately and by transporting me to another time with his mere words. Tell me more, I say dreamily, as I place a pillow on his lap before laying my head down. He gazes indulgently at me, his hand on my head as he softly strokes my hair.
What do you want to know exactly?
I think for a moment. What do you know about 18th century England? He raises his brows at me.
How come?
I've read books set during the Regency. I'm interested in what happened before. I turn to lay on my back so I can watch him.
Depending on what decade of the 1800s you're talking about, a lot of things have changed. The end of the century was very similar to what you know as the Regency.
He goes on to give me a quick political and societal guide to the 1700s. I merely listen, my lips tipped up in a perpetual smile as I let his deep rumble wash through me. Every vibration makes me feel unnaturally alive and yearning for something. Caleb, I interrupt after what seems like an eternity. He's on the subject of George III, making parallels between England and the colonies, and how people had fared under his rule.
Huh?
He suddenly stops, tilting his head and turning those captivating eyes to me. Rising from my very comfortable spot, I bring myself into a sitting position, sliding next to him as I cup both his cheeks with my hands. A sliver of fear blooms inside of me, but for the first time I squash it down, choosing to take matters into my own hands. He blinks, and for the first time I note he is flustered, a fact that only makes him more endearing. This handsome man, who's been trying to seduce me at every turn, is now being the one seduced, and instead of the expected resolute assertiveness, I'm met with tentative uncertainty. His skin is soft where my fingers touch him, and I caress him gently before I lean in. My heart is thundering in my chest, but as I close the distance between us, my lips meeting his, I find that nothing else matters. Nothing but that brief connection as I inhale the very essence he breathes. I give him a quick kiss on the lips before I draw back, my eyes wide, my cheeks red. To my surprise, his cheeks have a similar hue. Unable to face him, I swing my legs off the sofa and I dash out of the library. See you later! I squeak. I giggle to myself as I run up the stairs, ready to close myself in my room and replay everything in my head. But just as I'm about to turn to our wing, I come face to face with Rhiannon.
There you are, Darcy.
She smiles at me.
My nephew told me about your misfortune, and I must offer you my deepest apologies.
I frown.
You shouldn't encounter any more such.
She purses her lips.
Creatures.
That is reassuring. I give her a tight smile.
Of course, you must have questions. I'd like to extend an invitation to dine with the family at the end of the week. We've all been rather absent, and we've unfortunately neglected you as our guest.
Oh, no, don't worry about it. I don't want to impose. You've already received me into your home, for which I am incredibly grateful.
It is your home, too, Darcy.
She comes forward, taking my hands in hers. For a moment, I could swear her eyes glow just as a smile slowly spreads on her lips.
Oh, my, you are indeed everything I expected you to be,
she tells me, giving me a warm look.
We will talk more soon, and I will give you answers to some questions you may have.
And with that, she's gone. Heading to my room, I note how late it is and I get ready for bed, taking a shower and washing my hair. All the while, I can't stop smiling while thinking of Caleb, while thinking of the kiss. Already, my cheeks heat up as I remember the feel of his lips on mine. It had only been for a second, but it had been glorious. So much so that I can't wait to repeat it. Brushing my hair and braiding it, I put on my nightgown before I go to bed. As I lay in bed, doing my best to fall asleep, I can't help but compare the sweet kiss I'd shared with Caleb with the one I am almost certain Eamon gave me. I shake myself. I shouldn't even try to compare. One man is dead, the other is alive. Yet why does it hurt so much thinking of Eamon dead? I have Caleb, and that should be enough. So why can't I stop my heart from yearning for Eamon? If my intuition is right, the dreams aren't just dreams, not after Eamon spoke to me. They are a window to the past, one where I was his Lizzie, one where we were in love. But what happened? Why is he here in Fairydale? Why is he a ghost? The questions are endless, and I feel more conflicted than ever. I like Caleb. I am attracted to him. And I know I'm well on my way to falling for him if I haven't already done so. But then there's Eamon, and the echo of feelings I had for him as Lizzie. Feelings that still plague me, a gaping hole in my heart whenever I think about him. He's the only person whose presence has ever reminded me of home. God, I groan as I twist and turn. I'm falling for Caleb, but I'm also in love with a ghost. What in God's name is wrong with me? Before, I'd never looked twice at a man, and now I'm having this infuriating conundrum. Anywhere other than Fairydale, and I'm sure I would be shipped to a mental institution. After all, who develops feelings for a ghost? It takes me a while to fall asleep, but at some point, a loud banging noise startles me awake. My first inclination is to get out of bed and turn on the light, already feeling myself develop goosebumps over the surface of my entire body. Please, not another ghost. Maybe I've let myself be spoiled in the last week, but the quiet had been invaluable. Another bang, and I jump, looking right and left. The issue with ghosts is that you cannot just punch them and run for your life. They're not exactly punchable. The noise becomes increasingly louder, and just as I am about to go find Caleb, I hear the voice. His voice.
Lizzie.
It's faint, but I can hear it. Eamon? I ask, hating the hopeful tone of my voice.
Lizzie.
The air shimmers in front of me, and somehow I know it's him. Eamon, I whisper softly, his name on my lips almost making me cry since I know he's dead. The shimmery mist moves, going towards the door. I frown for a second until I realize he's trying to tell me something, lead me somewhere. Before I can think anything through, I light a candle, taking it with me and following Eamon's ghost, or essence, or whatever it is. At this point, the last thing I need is to argue semantics over a ghost's form, not when the only thing that matters to me is to be able to communicate with him. I have so many questions I want to ask him, so many things I want to tell him.
Lizzie.
The voice becomes louder as I move down the corridor, taking the stairs to the ground floor before being led to an area I hadn't been before. but one Caleb had told me had been the servants' quarters in the past. The moment I enter it, the mist directs me to a door at the far end of the room. As I open it, shining light inside, I'm surprised to see a set of stairs that lead to an even lower level. For a second, I balk at going into such a dark place, but as the mist intensifies, I take the plunge, putting one foot in front of the other and hoping I'm not going to encounter God knows what down there. I go down two flights of stairs before I reach another door, this one locked. I'm about to tell him that when I hear a light snapping sound before the door creaks open. As I cross the threshold, I use the candle to see what's around me, somehow not surprised to see it's a tunnel. The ground is rocky and uneven, and I think I can hear the sound of the ocean, which suggests this is close to sea level. I take a few steps, but I can't feel him around me anymore. Amen?
Come to me.
The voice is fully audible now, raspy, full, and thick. There's almost an echo as it fills the length of the tunnel. Amen, is that you?
Come to me, Lizzie mine.
He drawls, the voice unmistakably his. I would recognize it anywhere. Tears gather at the corners of my eyes as I hurry forward. It's really you, I whisper, true joy overtaking me. It's really you, my Amen. I don't know how far I've walked, but suddenly I hit something like a wall, the impact making me reel. Swinging the candle in front of me, I note there's no barrier. Nothing. What?
Come, Lizzie.
Amen repeats, his voice deeply anguished. So much so, it pulls at my soul, a melody that calls to something deep within me. Getting up, I try to move forward again, only to be thrust backward once more. But I don't give up. Moving back a few paces, I gather momentum before I run at full speed towards the invisible barrier, only to be thrown back in the air with the same force. I hit the ground instantaneously. My head connects with a sharp rock, the pain immediate, as is the blurring of my vision and the loss of my consciousness. But it's not before I hear a mighty roar, one that makes the entire structure around me quake.
Lizzie!
Chapter 13. September 1790, Havisham House, Kent.
She hasn't been herself in months, my lady. You have to do something about it.
I vaguely hear Mary's voice outside my bedroom door.
She'll get over it, just as she'll get over that thing.
My mother spits the words, once more making her stance regarding Amen clear.
But she won't. It's been months, my lady, and all she does is sit in her room and stare out the window. She doesn't eat, unless we force it down her throat. She doesn't do anything but wither away one day at a time.
Mary adds, exasperated. I feel bad for her. It's not her fault, but even the affection I hold for her won't be able to move me.
It's just puppy love. She'll get over it soon. We're leaving for London at the end of the month, whether she likes it or not.
My mother declares before her steps become a thudding noise on the floor, slowly fading away. A knock at my door, and Mary slips inside, slowly coming towards me.
My lady,
she says tentatively as she reaches my side.
You need to pull yourself together. Please.
Her voice breaks, and a flicker of emotion takes shape in my chest. But I don't answer. It's been exactly 3 months since I last spoke, 3 months of the same recurring nightmare, of waking up and seeing the blood on my hands, 3 months of living while being dead on the inside. At first, I'd been so inconsolable my mother had forced me into a laudanum-induced slumber that had lasted almost a week. I don't have much recollection of what happened during that time, but from the crumbs I've gathered from Mary, I'd been in and out of it, but every time I'd regain consciousness, I would go crazy with grief, and I would devolve into hysterics. That had stopped when I'd simply become numb with pain. I'd gone from seeing my beloved bleeding out in my arms to waking up alone and inconsolable. To make matters worse, even Mr. Meow had left me. I don't know what had happened to him, but I don't discount that my mother could have thrown him out while I was not able to defend him. Eamon is dead. And Fiona Montford had killed him with her own two hands. From the moment I'd heard the admission from her lips, I'd tuned her out, almost as if I'd stepped away from the present by closing myself somewhere deep within. I can only recall her telling me it was for my own good, that she was saving my life. But can she not see that instead she all but damned me?
"Do you need anything?"
Mary probes, laying a hand on my shoulder and trying to get me to react. I don't. I simply continue to gaze out the window, moonlight shining over the well-groomed shrubs. The perfect outside image, hiding the rot within. With a resigned sigh, she places a tray of food on a table, telling me to help myself if I get hungry, even though she knows come morning everything will be intact. The seconds tick before I hear the door close behind her. I mentally acknowledge it, my body sagging as some tension leaves me. Still, I don't move. My limbs are stiff and numb from sitting in the same positions for hours at a time. Yet, I relish the discomfort. It's the only thing I deserve for getting him killed, because if it hadn't been for me... A sigh escapes me as I intently regard the garden that housed our first meeting, almost as if by staring at it I could undo the past, or go back to the past. Back to that one first meeting. That time when I could still hear his voice in my ear, feel his breath on my cheek, or the touch of his ungloved hand against mine. The little things that made me fall for him. The little things that are the only memories I have of him. A tear makes its way down my cheek as I recall his sweet words.
"Lizzie mine."
For a brief moment in time, I was his. Truly his. And he was mine. It doesn't matter what my mother says. That he was a bad man. That he was a debaucher of innocence and the epitome of evil. He could have been that and more, but for that moment in the maze, when he looked at me as if I were his entire world, I know he was mine, so irrevocably mine. If only she wouldn't have found us. A whimper escapes me as the images of that night flood me. I can recall his smile perfectly. Yet, as soon as the shots ring out, I can barely make out blurry movements and red. So much red. On my hands, on my gown, spattered all over my face. One moment I loved him, ready to give myself to him in spite of the impropriety of it, in spite of the entire world. The next, he was dead. And I was dead too. Hours pass, and the house becomes eerily quiet, everyone having gone to sleep. I stay a few moments longer before I release a weary sigh, slowly untangling my limbs as I get up from my seat by the window. My stomach rumbles with hunger as I pass by the food Mary had left for me, yet I can't muster the appetite, nor the need for self-preservation. Starvation is both an act of rebellion and one of pure disinterest when it comes to my well-being, especially as I know what will happen next. My mother will find me a husband to keep things quiet, and I'll be locked in another form of terror. At least like this, I'm still master of my own fate. The mere thought of someone other than Eamon touching me has disgust rolling deep inside of me, goosebumps of revulsion covering my entire skin. People might think I'm ridiculous for doing this, for hanging on to something that was barely real, for what they call puppy love. But they can judge me all they want. I know what's in my heart, and what was between us. I am the one who has to live with this heartbreak, with the memory of what he made me feel both at the height of happiness and at the lowest of the low, when his blood has stained my body. Slipping the gown over my head, I stand in front of the full-sized mirror, letting my eyes roam over my figure, or what's left of it. My stomach has sunk in, my ribs poking through the skin. My hip bones, too, are protruding, as seemingly are all the bones in my body. In just a few months, I've become a shell of myself. The only question is, how long will I be able to go on like this? For fear that I would do something stupid, my mother has ordered the servants to ransack my room for any sharp objects or anything I could use to harm myself. She'd noticed the dullness in my eyes from the moment I woke up, and she realized that with one pull of a trigger, she hadn't just killed Eamon. She'd killed me, too. Releasing a tired breath, I drag myself to my bed, but one small movement taking all the energy out of me. My lungs are as tired as my limbs, and as soon as my back hits the mattress, my eyes flutter closed. The only light in the room is coming from the fireplace, the embers flickering with the life I wish I had, with the fire I wish still burned within me. Yet it's that warmth that reminds me of him, of the heat of his body. It's only in times like this that I can still hold on to him, with my eyes closed, my mind drifting to the past. Or maybe the potential future, the one I know I'll never have, but the one I yearn for nevertheless. In my dreams, Eamon is with me, as my friend, lover, husband, and father of my children. And as I turn in bed, keeping to one half of it, I imagine it's him on the other side. "I miss you," I whisper, the void swallowing my words and never delivering anything back. As a tear falls down my cheek, I picture the alternative. I see us running in the garden, smiling at one another while playing with our children. We're happy. God, but we're happy. One tear eventually becomes 100, until I curl inwards, hugging my legs to my chest and sobbing my heart out for the future that will never be. Yet, just as I find myself lost in my grief, a strong gust of wind blows the windows open, cold seeping into the room. Immediately I stand up, though it's not the easiest thing to do. It's even harder to get out of bed and trudge my way to the window to close it. The wind blows in my face, a shiver going down my back from the cold. Wincing, I drape a red shawl over my shoulders in an attempt to warm myself. With slow, even steps, I reach the window, my hands on the wooden frames as I struggle to close them. A storm is brewing, and the wind picks up strength as I do my best to push the windows closed. Yet, before I manage to seal them shut, something floats inside the room. I don't pay attention to it until every latch is in place. Still shivering, I pick up the piece of paper, short of breath from the mere effort of bending down. As my fingers brush against it, I don't look at what it is. My first instinct is to dump it in the fireplace, anything to get the room warmer. It's by chance that I gaze down at it, and two words capture my attention.
Lizzie mine.
I blink in confusion, my pulse speeding up just as a foreign feeling blossoms in my chest. Hope. It can't be. Can it? With hurried movements that my body can barely withstand, I borrow some fire from the fireplace, lighting up a candle and taking a seat at my table. Taking a deep breath, I slowly unfold the piece of paper, my eyes quickly scanning the contents of the letter at first. Gulping down, I note the key words and phrases, all belonging to Eamon, and I can't help the happiness that takes shape within me. My fingers tremble as I bring my gaze to the beginning, reading everything with slow exactitude so I don't miss one word.
Lizzie mine, forgive me for not writing to you sooner. The road to recovery has been long and harrowing. For days on end, I did not know whether I would be able to utter your name out loud again. Against all odds, I prevailed, and it is only because of you, my love, because of this love that burns inside my veins, this want that threatens to suffocate me. It's because my desire for you is stronger than any weapon or any roadblock I may encounter in this life or the next. Please know that I am alive and well, and I will soon come for you. Yours eternally, Amen.
I read the letter again and again. I read it until I memorize each word, and still I cannot believe this to be true. Amen, I whisper, my chest bursting with the purest happiness there is. It's really you, isn't it? The candle burns out, and I'm still staring at his words, committing to memory the curves of his letters, the hoops and the little particularities, all so I can convince myself this is real. Amen is alive. He's not dead. Dear God, he's not dead. I stand up, albeit a little too suddenly. A wave of dizziness assaults me, all the blood rushing to my head. Yet I can't find it in me to care, not when I've been given a new purpose, to live. What could he possibly think if he saw me like this, all skin and bone and almost expiring on the spot? Not only would he find me entirely unappealing, but he would worry. I know he would. Pursing my lips, I drop to my knees by the bed, searching for a little box that holds my dearest possessions. Pulling it closer, I carefully fold the letter inside so no one would find it. Then I bring my gaze to the tray of cold food. My stomach rumbles again. Yet this time, and this time only, I know I can keep the food down. I know that I can eat, if only to survive another day and see him again. That day signals the start of my own recovery. Though my appetite doesn't magically return, I do my best to eat a little more each day. The efforts are soon visible in the new fullness of my cheeks and my figure. My hair, too, slowly regains its previous luster, and with a perpetual smile on my face, things start looking up, my hope for the future growing daily. Amon's letters continue, too. Every couple of days I find a new letter on my windowsill. I don't know how he does it, but he never fails to surprise me with his words, promising me a future together whether my mother approves of our relationship or not. Knowing he has plans in store for us, that at one point my dreams would become reality, I can't help the giddiness that suffuses my being. So much so that soon everyone notices, including my mother.
"You're looking well, Elizabeth,"
she notes one morning as she sees me come down for breakfast.
"You've been eating, too."
I nod dutifully. "You were right, Mother." I give her a small smile. "It was puppy love. I now realize that. But you can't blame me for being crushed. You saw how handsome he was." I do my best to explain, masking the distaste that assails me at those lies. My mother's eyes widen. Placing down her fork and knife, she studies me intently.
"Do you mean that, dear?"
"Of course," I murmur. "I was courting death, and for what? Because some gentleman decided to pay me attention for 5 seconds. I realize how naive I've been." I sigh. "I can only blame it on my lack of experience, and the fact that I was an easy prey." My mother nods, a satisfied smile pulling at her lips as she undoubtedly thinks I've finally seen reason. And if I am to succeed in my ruse, at least long enough for Amon to come for me, then I must convince her I am cured of my silly infatuation.
"That is good to hear, dear. You are a clever girl. I knew you'd see reason."
"I do have one question," I add, as I pile my plate with food. Her eyes sparkle with approval as she sees me eat, nodding encouragingly at me. "You killed a man, a nobleman. Why is no one inquiring about that? Why is there no magistrate knocking on our door?" Her smile doesn't wane.
I think it's high time I let you in on our family secret, Elizabeth,
she says, watching me closely as I bring a piece of ham to my lips. Family secret? I frown.
Well, there are several reasons why I could go ahead with the murder, as you call it. At such a public event, too.
She chuckles.
And that is because no one knows. No one saw, and no one heard.
But the shot. It was so loud. Everything was so loud. Fiona shakes her head.
Eamon D'Artagnan doesn't exist, dear. He never did. There was no Marquis d'Ombre. No such title was ever created.
You mean he was a charlatan? I narrow my eyes at her. It's the first time she's mentioned that. Before, the only thing she'd said about Eamon had been that he was a bad man and that he was trying to take advantage of me and lead me astray.
Oh, along those lines,
she laughs.
Only much, much more dangerous. But I reckon you're finally ready to learn the truth.
The truth? I blink. What sort of truth could she be speaking about?
Join me,
she says as she rises from her chair. Curious about this family secret she wishes to share with me, I grab a scone on my way out, popping it into my mouth before following her. She enters the main library, going straight for a shelf and plucking a particular volume. I don't get to see the title before a sudden noise makes me jump back. Right before my eyes, the entire wall opens up to reveal a secret room. What's going on? I whisper, my eyes widening in shock.
Come, dear.
She urges me on, taking me by the hand and inviting me inside. The moment we're in the secret chamber, the wall moves again, closing itself behind us. It's only then that I manage to take in the room around me. What? My mouth opens and closes in wonder. The room is almost the same size as the main library, and it seems to house another collection of books and other items. There are shelves upon shelves of ingredients and odd contraptions that look strikingly similar to drawings of items I'd seen in scientific treatises. An enormous book rests in the middle of the room, protected by a glass box. Even from where I'm standing, I can tell the pages are made of vellum, not paper. What is this, Mama?
This is your legacy, Elizabeth,
she declares. Clasping her hands together, she invites me to look around the room. I don't understand. Did Papa know about this?
Your father?
She frowns.
Of course not.
She waves her hand in the air as if he were not in the least important.
Some of these items have been in my family for centuries, and the knowledge for millennia.
I take a step forward, walking around the room and studying its contents, more questions arising in my mind. There are odd-looking symbols drawn on the walls, and every single book I see is in Latin or Gaelic. Mother, I look up, my tone serious as I address her. Tell me this isn't some type of witchcraft. Though the aristocracy refuses to acknowledge such pagan notions, the rumors still float around, usually among the servants who are more susceptible to superstitions. But with the past waves of witch-hunting, even they are wary not to say too much. Parliament officially passed the Witchcraft Act in 1735, thus ending the official witch-hunt. That didn't stop various clerics, particularly in more remote regions, from accusing and punishing individuals. Sometimes even a home remedy could be labelled as witchcraft, its maker branded a witch and castigated to the full extent of clerical law. Fiona merely smiles. She doesn't deny it. I freeze, my heart ramming in my chest as I look at the mother I've known my entire life, yet now I'm seeing someone different. Someone with secrets. Someone who wasn't quite who I thought she was. You must realize this is madness. There's no such thing as witchcraft. I try to tell her in the nicest way possible. Not only is my mother potentially insane,
but she'd attacked my beloved based on some inane assumptions.
You're new to all of this.
I understand it might be hard for you to understand, but I'll do my best to explain everything.
She smiles. I think I'll retire for the day, I murmur, giving her a forced smile as I take a step back, turning and assessing the mobile wall. Surely if I find the right title, it's going to move and...
Not so fast, dear,
my mother calls out. Before I can even contemplate my exit, I feel myself being dragged backwards. Frowning, I try to fight the pull, focusing all my strength in my legs as I place one foot forward, then another. But it's all in vain when I get pulled once more, this time with enough strength that I fly. I fly.
What? I squeak as I find myself floating in the air. My eyes find my mother's knowing smirk, and somehow I know this is all her doing.
There's no such thing as witchcraft, dear?
She asks, a smile on her face. I blink repeatedly.
Put me down, please! I beg, flailing my arms around as panic overtakes me.
With a wave of her hand, I'm back on the ground. My feet meet the floor, and I swear I could kiss it with the amount of fear still running through my veins.
What was that?
My features must be pale, my entire countenance mirroring the terror I feel on the inside.
I'm dreaming, I whisper to myself. I must be dreaming. That's it.
You're not dreaming, Elizabeth,
my mother assures me, taking a step forward and planting herself in front of me. She reaches for me, and instinctively I flinch away from her touch, thinking she's going to do another odd demonstration and actually hurt me.
You're safe,
she says softly, no doubt seeing the distress written all over my features.
I'm not going to hurt you.
I don't understand.
I whimper in shock, rubbing my arms in a gesture of self-soothing.
I don't understand what's happening.
I know,
she sighs,
and I'm going to explain this to you. Come.
She takes me by my hand, leading me to the table in the center of the room that houses the vellum manuscript.
I'll start at the beginning.
She gives me a tight smile.
I'm sure you must have a preconceived notion about witchcraft, though we prefer to call ourselves the Coven of Light. The Church has done a marvelous job of putting all of us in the same basket and calling us devil worshippers. Yes, it is true that there are those out there who choose the dark side, and their power comes from the dark. But just as there is dark, so there is light.
She pauses, checking with me to see if I'm following. I give her a slow nod, though my mind is still reeling with confusion and disbelief, anxiety coursing through my veins. How can I possibly believe what she's saying? Despite the evidence staring me in the face, I have a hard time reconciling what I knew of my mother with what she's telling me, that she's some type of magical being with the ability to move objects with her mind. I've always considered myself a rational individual, using facts to form an opinion, and though magic seems too far removed from reality, I cannot deny that my mother is presenting me with facts.
There are 6 main families scattered around the world that fight on behalf of the light, and we are part of one of them,
she says as she brings forth an old scroll with a snap of a finger. Laying it on the table in front of me, she unfolds it with her powers. The material is yellow and worn out. As I tentatively reach with one finger, I find the material smooth and silky. Vellum.
This is our family. Stuart.
She points to a huge genealogical tree that starts at the top of the scroll with the first Stuart, going down until I can find my mother's name at the bottom, too. The scroll has a striking feature, though. It only traces the female line. Only women? I ask, tracing the ancient lineage. She nods, a bright smile appearing on her face.
The Stuart abilities are passed down only through the female line. Usually they are manifested through an innate talent,
like my telekinesis. But we also have the ability to do rituals and spells that require different incantations, ingredients, and of course different degrees of difficulty.
She goes on to tell me a little about the other families. For three families, the powers are passed down through females. For the other three, it's through the male line. Most importantly, major rituals require one member from each family to perform forbidden spells. What do you mean by major ritual? I frown.
Come here.
She motions me to follow her to the glass box that houses the vellum manuscript. Using her telekinesis, she removes the glass, placing it on a faraway table and giving me a direct view of the manuscript. Up close, I can see the exquisite penmanship and the beautiful illustrations on the first page.
This is the Codex Stuartorum. It dates back to the 6th century AD and it represents our oath to the light.
Waving her hand over the surface of the first page, she whispers,
"Revelate."
And the Latin text becomes legible in English. My eyes widen in awe, but I don't comment on it. I'll have plenty of time to digest the information later. For now, I give the document my full attention as I read its contents. You swear to use your powers not for personal gain, but only for one purpose, eradicating evil entities. I quote aloud from the Codex. Demons? I suddenly burst out. Fiona nods grimly.
Since we all possess these unique abilities, the elders were afraid that we would use them for nefarious purposes. As such, they came together with a solution. Each family would sign a blood oath to only do good. And to further limit abuses of power, each family's codex is incomplete.
She recounts as she flips the pages of the codex, showing that many of the pages contain only a few paragraphs.
There are spells out there that are far too powerful to belong to only one family, let alone one individual. As such, the elders broke apart fragments of the most dangerous and forbidden spells and split them among the 6 families.
But what if there is an emergency? You said the families are scattered across the globe. How could you get all the fragments assembled in time? I ask pensively. A mischievous smile pulls at her lips.
There is at least one teleporter per generation. It's their job to gather everyone once a year during our annual meetings,
she explains. That's a lot to take in, I admit.
I know,
she sighs,
and it's just scratching the surface. You see, like with all aspects of life, with good comes bad. Just like there are those like us that belong to the light, there are those who belong to the dark.
Do you mean there are similar families that belong to the dark side? My mother purses her lips.
Not quite. There are those that acquire power through dark means, by selling their souls to the devil, so to speak. But they are usually solitary beings. Power is too intoxicating to share.
She shakes her head in disapproval.
Our main enemies are those dark beings that encroach into our world where they do not belong and prey on those weak men hungry for power.
She gives me a short biblical explanation about the origin of demons and fallen angels and the fact that the Coven of Light is purported to derive its powers from divine origins. I nod along, though I can tell she's giving me the abridged version of everything, making me wonder what she's not telling me.
When Earth teemed with demons and fallen, God realized he needed to protect his creations, so he bestowed gifts upon 6 families, gifts that would help them fight against evil and keep humanity safe.
She pauses.
Or so the legend goes.
She chuckles. I narrow my eyes at her. Or so the legend goes. The more I listen to her, the more I have to wonder why now? Why tell me now when it's clear that she should have done so years ago, if I believe that mothers should pass down their knowledge to their daughters? Let me understand this. You're saying magic is real, that our family has magic, and now you're telling me there are angels and fallen and demons and evil entities?
That is exactly what I'm telling you, Elizabeth. And what's worse is that those evil entities live among us, wreaking havoc wherever they go. They thrive on chaos, destruction, war, and suffering. And they love watching humanity lose itself.
And of course you're there to stop them. I roll my eyes at her. She nods.
I'm aware I haven't been the best mother to you, but know that I've always had your best interests at heart, and all I've done has been to create a better world for my children. For you.
Growing up, both my parents had been rather absent. Not that it was anything out of the ordinary, since nobility often let the staff raise the children. My father had lost himself in his vices, and my mother had had her commitments, which, if I'm to believe her, had included slaying demons all over the world.
"Why are you telling me this now?" I demand. As I'd seen the trajectory of her story, I'd intuited how this all related to me and... Aemon. Even so, I'm almost afraid to hear it from her lips. But more than anything, I'm afraid it could be true. It couldn't. Could it?
Because you need to know why I killed that man. You need to know what he was.
My mother replies staunchly, setting her steely gaze on me. What do you mean? I ask softly. Flicking her wrist, she turns the codex to another page, one that has the illustration of a woman's body. My eyes go wide with disbelief as I stare from the manuscript to my mother and back to the manuscript, the question written all over my face.
All your life, I've told you how special you were, Elizabeth, did I not?
She gives me a soft smile, one that is quite rare to see on my mother's face. What is this, Mama? I ask, almost afraid of the implications.
My mother, your grandmother, had the gift of foresight. When I was pregnant with you, she knew you would be special. So special that the entire world would covet your gift.
What gift? I whisper, an ominous shiver going down my body.
The gift of healing,
my mother says, wiping a tear away. I frown. Why is that so precious?
Because.
She comes closer, bringing her hand to my chest, right on top of my birthmark. The same mark is illustrated in the codex.
Yes, there are other people that can heal injuries to a degree. But what you have...
She shakes her head, pure emotion shining in her eyes.
This doesn't just heal physical wounds, Elizabeth. It heals the essence of the soul.
My brows pinch together as I try to understand what's so great about it, aside from the fact that I've never in my life healed myself or others. How is it that I have this gift, but I've never felt its presence?
Though demons can live forever, they are not invincible, and in order to kill them, we need to destroy their essences. A demon is considered dead only once its essence is nullified.
She pauses, biting her lip.
For them, your gift is like a fountain of immortality. They can drink out of it and preserve their life forever.
But I've never seen evidence of any such gift, I protest.
That's because of me,
she immediately answers, a sad smile tugging at her lips.
There was only one other confirmed case in history. A woman who died before she reached her majority because of that ability. She was a beacon for demons, and she was killed by one of them, drained of her power. I never wanted that for you, so I bound your powers at birth.
What?
I thought if I did that, you could lead a normal life, that you would grow to your majority, marry someone and have your own family. But I never imagined they would still find you, that he would find you.
By he, you mean? Aemon. She nods grimly. You can't possibly think he's a demon. I shake my head, taking a step back. No, I refuse to believe that.
He is a demon, Elizabeth. I don't know what kind, and frankly I do not care. I'm only concerned about you and the fact that you were so close to— She chokes on a cry. He could have killed you. He could have drained you.
Yet, as I look at her and her motive display, one I've never seen her display towards me before, I can't help but wonder if she was concerned about me, or about the fact that Aemon could become invincible because of me. Today is the most animated I've seen my mother in. Forever. How do you know? I inquire, keeping my tone even, though all I want is to scream to her that Aemon is innocent. That he could never... She purses her lips, her features tight, and for a moment I don't think she's going to reply. Then, the codex pages suddenly flip again. My eyes widen, my entire being assailed by disbelief.
That is your Aemon, dear,
she says, and even through my veil of shock, I can detect a hint of smugness.
A demon we've been hunting for centuries.
Bringing my eyes back to the codex, I peruse the drawing of a man with long white hair and equally white eyes. The artist had done a phenomenal job, every line and every stroke matching Aemon's features. So much so that I find myself speechless.
Every member of the coven knows about his existence. He is one of the most powerful demons we've ever come across, and it's only because...
She pauses, her teeth raking over her bottom lip as she scrunches her brows in worry. Because? I inquire, almost certain I'm not going to like her answer.
He was the demon who killed the other girl, the one with your birthmark. He's the one who consumed her essence, and the moment he did that, no one could measure up to him, even with all the six families involved. He was too powerful.
She sighs. Suddenly, things are starting to become clearer. Like why Aemon had survived. But there is one thing that keeps bothering me. If Aemon was so powerful, if he was so dangerous, why not cut our sojourn short at the Duchess's house? If she thought he would become so invincible if he got access to me, why did she not take me away the first chance she had? Unless... I swallow hard, hating that I'm doubting her, or Aemon, or my own damn existence. Yet how can I not be a mass of confusion when I've just been told that my entire life has been a lie, that nothing is as it seems? You said to kill a demon, you need to nullify his essence, I suddenly add. What did you do to him, after the shooting? If he is so powerful... I doubt he would have died just from a few shots.
You're clever.
She clicks her tongue against her teeth.
You're right. The shot didn't kill him. It merely wounded him long enough so we could get our hands on him, so we would contain him until all six families were present to nullify him.
And she shrugs.
He's dead.
But he's not. I know he's not. And she must know he's not. That means my mother is lying to me. Is it to protect me, or is there something more? She continues to talk, droning on about the family legacy and the fact that my sister had already been initiated into it, and she is to become the next Stuart matriarch. Once more, I have to wonder why she hadn't told me any of this earlier, why she'd waited until I met Aemon to do so. And because of that, I can't help but feel there are more things she is hiding from me.
I really thought sealing your magic would keep you away from this life. I'm sorry, Elizabeth, but it's better that you now know. It wasn't my intention to make you suffer. I was just protecting you.
Nodding, I listen to everything more she has to say before I retire for the day. It's close to midnight when I get to my room, closing the door behind me and managing to remove my simple gown without ringing for Mary. At this moment, I'd rather be alone with my thoughts. The story my mother told me is ludicrous at best. Yet I can't deny her ability to move things with a flick of her wrist or the items she houses in that secret chamber of hers, including the Codex Stuatorum. Though a part of me may believe there is some truth to her words, I'm still skeptical about many things. After I've removed all my clothes, I stand in front of the mirror, my attention focused on the tear-shaped mark above my breast. According to my mother, this is the core of all my problems, because it designates me as someone with the power to heal. Demons. It makes me a beacon for demons, and the reason Aemon had pursued me in the first place. But while the things I've learned cast doubt about everything that's ever happened in my life, including Aemon, there are still unanswered questions, and one still bothers me. For all my mother's explanations about Aemon being the epitome of evil, who wants to leech on me to become even more powerful, some things don't fit. That time at the Duchess's house hadn't been my first encounter with Aemon, and during the first one, he could have very well done anything he wanted to me, and I wouldn't have been able to stop him. He'd been in my room. He could have easily taken advantage of me. Yet he hadn't. He hadn't even been improper. Moreover, why had my mother not insisted we leave the house party as soon as she saw him? Why let me be under the same roof as a dangerous demon if it weren't because I was bait? Chapter 14. November 1790, London, Great Britain. My first season began quite uneventfully. Mama, my sister Olivia, and I have been in London for almost a month now. Between my introduction at court, securing vouchers at Almack's, and gaining the approval of all the influential Tun matriarchs, I've barely found the time to breathe. It didn't help that my mother took it upon herself to offer me an introductory course into the ways of the coven, with my sister assisting her. If before I would have had doubts about my mother's intentions, now they have tripled. Olivia seems to be aware of everything regarding the coven, and when I'd asked her how she knew so much, she'd told me she's had years to study all the books and materials. I would be lying if I said I didn't feel a modicum of jealousy considering I was the last to find out. But since my last stunt, I've decided that nothing can be solved by acting out. All it does is hurt myself, and ultimately that is not the goal. As such, I've gone along with my mother and Olivia, putting on my best behavior and becoming a veritable debutante, all in the hopes that soon Aemon would contact me, and I would be able to get the information directly from him. I may have a myriad of questions, but because I am not convinced by either side, I want to hear his truth, too. I'm not going to crucify him before offering him a fair trial. The only unfortunate thing is that his letters have become sparser. The last one I'd received had been 2 weeks ago, and he'd only written one thing.
Wait for me, Lizzie mine.
The letter had been delivered at our London house in the same manner as the others. The window would suddenly open, and the letter would float in. That suggests he knows I am in London, and he knows where I live. I cannot comprehend why he would not come see me, since I know he could do it if he wanted to. Then the only alternative is that he doesn't want to. No, that cannot be true. I am sure he is just biding his time. Maybe he has some ongoing issues that need to be addressed first, or maybe he is trying to find a way to bypass my mother. In Havisham, my mother had confessed that she'd placed magical runes all over the property to impede any unwelcome visitor from crossing our threshold. I am not sure if she's done the same with the London house, but there are plenty of other places where he could find me, if he wanted to. Releasing a hopeless breath, I allow Mary to help me with my dress and style my hair. Since the beginning of the season, I've acquired a plethora of new gowns, all in pastel colours as befitting of any respectable debutante. From the beginning, my mother has insisted I put an effort into my appearance. Though she hasn't directly told me so, I know she's trying to orchestrate a match for me. An eavesdropped conversation between my mother and sister had confirmed as much. Fiona fears Aemon will not be the only one to come for me, and the best recourse for that is to marry me off and use my future husband's aura to cloak my presence. Though I'd been found before I heard more details about that particular process, that had been enough to put me on guard at every event we've been to, looking around and wondering who else could be part of their society.
You look stunning, my lady.
Mary praises as she steps back, letting me examine my hairstyle. Thank you, I murmur appreciatively, rising from my chair and getting ready to depart. My mother, Olivia, and her husband are already downstairs waiting for me.
There you are, Elizabeth,
my mother announces.
That pale pink suits you wonderfully. I'm so glad we picked it for you.
It does, doesn't it? Olivia agrees, while I merely nod, giving them a small smile.
I hope today you won't make another silly excuse not to dance,
my mother tells me when we are in the carriage and on the way to Lady Worcester's ball.
Your friend Emma always has her card full. You should learn something from her.
I school my features so my distaste towards dancing doesn't show. Not when the only memory I want of dancing is with Aemon. Regardless of whether I try or not, I know no one will measure up to him. As such, for every ball or soiree we've been to so far, I've pretended to be ill or have a headache. I might have even broken my heel, accidentally, of course, all in an effort to avoid dancing with anyone other than him, my Aemon. Even Emma doesn't dance all the sets, I answer with a smile.
She's already engaged, Elizabeth,
she adds pointedly, the reproach clear. If I were engaged too, I would be given more leeway. With how many times my mother uses Emma as an example, I would have been jealous if not for the fact that the girl is an absolute sweetheart. We'd met when we'd both had our presentation at court, and we'd quickly become chums. She's lively, artless, and a joy to be around. From the moment we'd found each other, we'd stuck together, always finding a topic to chat about. I've never had a close friend before, so Emma's arrival in my life had been rather fortuitous, especially at a time when I needed someone to lean on the most. Emma is the daughter of Viscount Berkeley, the title currently being held by her brother, and she'd been lucky enough to attract the attention of the Earl of Folly from the first ball she'd attended. Most importantly, though, it is a love match, something that I'm extremely happy for her. As we reach the Worcester residence, the orchestra has already started playing, and a quadrille is in full swing. As soon as we are announced, we greet the hosts, after which Olivia and her husband are off to speak to some acquaintances, leaving me alone with my mother. A smile pulls at my mother's lips as she regards the dance floor, before she gives me a look that all but tells me I need to dance tonight, or else. Sighing, I gaze around the room, spotting Emma, her mother, the Dowager Viscountess Berkeley, and her brother, Lord Berkeley, by the refreshments table. My mother, seeing that Lady Berkeley is also present, urges me to join them while she greets some of her friends on the other side of the ballroom.
You don't look too thrilled to be here,
Emma whispers in my ear as I reach her side. I give her a pained nod. Mama is pestering me to dance today, and I fear I'm running out of excuses. I sigh. I've already used my entire arsenal, and she knows I'm doing it on purpose.
You poor thing,
she coos in jest.
You will expire on the spot if you dance with someone, will you not?
A giggle escapes me.
And we wouldn't want that now, would we?
Turning to Lady Berkeley and her son, I greet both, giving them a polite smile before Emma steers me into conversation again, telling me about her latest outing with Lord Folly and how much she likes him. I let her gush over her bow, a little jealous that she's experiencing all these wonderful moments with her beloved, while mine is missing. Or maybe he will never be recovered at all. In the 2 weeks since Aemon's last letter, I've been beside myself with worry as I've built up all sorts of scenarios in my head as to why he wouldn't write to me anymore, some more worrisome than others. At first, I despaired that he'd been caught and harmed by the coven, until I'd started thinking that maybe he doesn't want me anymore. that maybe he'd found out that my mother had sealed my powers, and as such, I was no longer useful to him.
Lady Elizabeth, you look extraordinary tonight.
Lord Berkeley offers me a compliment. I give him a tight smile. Thank you, Lord Berkeley. I incline my head.
Terence, you should dance with her, Emma suddenly quips. Her brother's eyebrows shoot up in surprise.
Emma? I hiss at her, unable to believe she'd said that.
Your mother wants you to dance. This is your best chance to show her you're behaving without having to withstand some boor's attentions.
At least you know, Terry, she explains. Her brother doesn't seem put off by the suggestion, and as I give it some thought, I nod thoughtfully, realizing it could help. Seeing me consider the request, Lord Berkeley turns to me.
Would you do me the honour of the next dance, Lady Elizabeth?
He asks as he extends his hand towards me. For a moment I falter. My heart thrums in my chest as I remember Aemon and the masquerade. Yet Emma is right. My mother will continue to pester me to dance and be active until she will undoubtedly force me to dance with someone of her choosing. This way, at least, it's someone I relatively know. I would love to, I answer, placing my gloved hand in his. Right at that moment, the quadrille ends, the orchestra switching to a minuet. The dance doesn't require much touching or too close proximity, and I'm grateful for that small mercy. But though I try to immerse myself in the moment, especially as I see everyone around me flushed and energized from the music, I fear I cannot do so. Not when the only thing I want to remember is Aemon's light smile as he twirled me on the dance floor, disregarding everyone and every convention as he'd moulded my body to his.
You seem to have a lot on your mind,
Lord Berkeley notes. Forgive me. I blushed as I realized I'd been caught red-handed fantasizing about someone who is most assuredly not my dance partner. Just wool-gathering, I suppose. I'm not very fond of dancing, I lie. Yes, I am. I love dancing, but only with one man.
I dare contradict you, my lady. You haven't missed a step so far, even though your mind is far away,
he says, as an eyebrow raised. I force a smile. Thank you. You're an exceptionally good dancer yourself. I'm just following your lead. He seems satisfied with my words, and as the dance continues, he attempts to draw me into conversation by telling me about his country seat in Berkeley and his passion for horses. I keep a pleasant smile on my face despite the fact that I'm neither knowledgeable about horses, nor do they interest me particularly. He must be a worthy horse indeed, my lord, I murmur after he tells me the exorbitant sum he paid for an Arabian purebred.
I have a new mare, too. We named her Moonlight for her dark colours mixed with light. I reckon you'd like her. And maybe Emma can convince you to come visit us in Berkeley during the summer.
He continues, describing his stables in great detail and telling me how much I would enjoy riding Moonlight. For the first time, I look him straight in the eye, his words dawning on me. Is Viscount Berkeley showing an interest in me? He gazes at me appreciatively, his eyes roving over my form and settling right on my chest. My eyes widen just as my cheeks redden from his blatant perusal. I clear my throat in an attempt to steer him away from my cleavage, but he doesn't react. He only raises his eyes a moment later, meeting mine and giving me a wide grin. Immediately, I regret having accepted his invitation to the dance. More than anything, I regret not being more attentive to the conversations around me. So busy I'd been with my own problems that I hadn't realized his words now or in the past could have been construed as interest. The dance draws to an end, and just as I hurry back to Emma's side, who is now joined by my mother, Viscount Berkeley proposes a turn around the room. I am about to refuse, but my mother, sensing the situation, gives me another pointed look, leaving me with no choice but to accept his offer. He places my arm on top of his as he continues to tell me more about his horses. I tune out most of his conversation, merely nodding along with a fake smile on my lips. Yet, just as he's returning me to my mother's side, he asks me the dreaded question.
May I call upon you tomorrow?
I bite my lip, ready to tell him no. But before I can do so, my mother, who is within hearing distance, interjects on my behalf. Of course, Lord Burghley, she would love that.
Oh, Elizabeth!
Emma rushes to my side, her tone enthusiastic. Though I do my best to maintain my smile, the only thing I want to do is leave everyone behind and retire to my own room. One dance because I tried to get my mother off my back, and it suddenly turned into the beginning of a courtship. The conversation flows animatedly as my mother proceeds to ask various questions of Viscount Burghley and his mother. Emma, the sweetheart that she is, tries to apologize for pushing me to dance with her brother.
I'm sorry,
she mentions when she notices that I look worse than someone waiting their turn at the gallows. You couldn't have known. I give her a tight smile.
I didn't know he fancied you, but maybe you could give him a chance. I know he's my brother, but he's such a wonderful gentleman.
I will, I tell her, the lie exclusively for the sake of our friendship. As soon as Lord Burghley calls on me tomorrow, I will make it known that I'm not interested in anything more and that he should not waste his time on me. Pleased with my reasoning, I wait for the evening to draw to an end, and to not give my mother further reason to agree to other meetings on my behalf, I accept other invitations to dance, albeit only from married gentlemen. Late in the night, as we make our way back home, my mother praises me for finally seeing reason. My cheeks hurt from too much smiling, my feet from too much dancing, and my head from putting on an act for so long. Yet it seems everyone bought it. One small win. It's only when we get back home, and I excuse myself to my room, that I can breathe relieved. I only let Mary undo some of my fastenings, the ones I cannot reach myself, before urging her to seek her bed. After too much socializing, the only thing I want is to be on my own. Once I've put on my nightgown, I let my hair loose and prepare for bed. Yet, before that, I can't help myself as I open the window, looking outside in case Eamon left me something. Disappointment fills me when I don't see anything, and as the room becomes chilly, I close the window. Quickly checking on the fire, I finally retire to my bed. Yet before I can draw the covers to slide inside, all the hairs on my body stand up. My spine stiffens, my entire body freezing on the spot. Only someone could trigger that type of awareness within me. Swiveling, I come face to face with him. Eamon, my beloved who is neither dead, nor injured, nor does he appear to be any worse for wear.
Did you miss me, Lizzie mine?
He murmurs, his eyes gleaming dangerously as he sets them on me. Eamon, I blink, taken aback by his sudden presence. What are you doing here? What? I don't get to say anything else as I find myself flat against the wall, his body molded to mine, his big hand splayed over my jaw as he keeps me in place, making sure I'm looking at him directly in the eye.
You danced with them,
he says through gritted teeth, tension radiating from him.
You let other men touch you,
he rasps.
Dance with you. You're killing me, Lizzie mine.
You weren't there, I whisper. How could you reproach me about this when you haven't shown your face in months? His face contorts in pain, almost as if my words physically hurt him.
I couldn't.
He breathes, his warm air fanning my face.
I couldn't come to you. Not yet.
But you could write. I raise my brows. You can leave those damn letters on my windowsill. And for what? To give me hope where there's none. He shakes his head.
You have it all wrong. Those letters were to show my commitment to you.
Commitment? I choke on the word. How come I haven't seen any evidence of that? I ask him pointedly.
You dare question my loyalty towards you?
He raises his voice, the question seemingly getting a rise out of him.
You have no idea the things I've done for you.
He hisses.
Everything I've ever done has been for you.
For me? Or for the mock I carry? I demand suddenly. He blinks in confusion, and with my free hand, I wrench down the neckline of my nightgown to show him my birthmark. I know who you are. Or, I should say, what you are. I tell him squarely, waiting to see his reaction. How many times have I envisioned this confrontation? How many times did I imagine he would tell me this is all a misunderstanding, that he isn't the man in the illustration, that he isn't a demon? But one look at him and I know everything is true. He is not human. And yet, why does that not scare me more? Why am I not more terrified of him and of everything he symbolizes? Why is it that for me, demon or not, evil or not, he is just Aemon, my Aemon, the owner of my heart?
What do you think you know?
He takes a step back, giving me some space, yet he doesn't remove his touch. His hands are still on my body, one arm snaked around my waist, the other on my jaw, slowly stroking my flesh. Despite my determination to see this conversation through, my body reacts to his nearness, a raging inferno developing in my chest, quite fitting considering his ilk. That you're a demon. I tilt my head to the side, studying him and his lack of reaction. That you're after what I can do for you, not truly for myself. He regards me for a moment before he chuckles.
I see your mother told you about me. What exactly did she tell you? That I'm a monster?
I nod.
That I'm evil personified and I need to be eradicated at all costs?
Again, I nod.
And of course, that I'm only after you because of this.
He says, as he brings his hand to my chest, on top of my gown. Before I can answer, though, he rips the material in two, leaving me bare and gasping. What?
I'm only after you for this, am I not?
He asks again, moving closer. Instinctively, I take a step back as I seek to cover myself. He doesn't let me, though. Catching my hand, he moves it aside as he lays his palm on top of my breast, covering my birthmark. His heat transfers to my body, his touch as intoxicating as it is forbidden. What are you doing? I whisper, realizing I'm seeing a different side of Aemon tonight. No longer the sweet gentleman from before, my savior. Now there's an intensity to him that scares me. Yet paradoxically, I'm not afraid. My heart beats faster in my chest as he applies more pressure on top of my skin, and I know he can sense exactly what his nearness is doing to me. His gaze holds me captive as he lets me witness the play of emotions on his face. Anger, passion, lust, love.
Is that what she told you, Lizzie mine, that I'm only after this cursed mark?
Yes, I whisper, unable to break eye contact.
And what do you think? Do you agree with her?
He murmurs softly, nuzzling his cheek against mine. I don't know, I answer honestly. She bound my abilities. That means the mark is inactive for now. But you could always...
It's irreversible, Lizzie. The binding spell your mother put on you is irreversible. Your mark will never be active.
I swallow uncomfortably. My mother had never told me that, She'd implied that there was still a chance it could be useful, and that it would still attract attention. But how could he have known? As soon as the question crosses my mind, though, I roll my eyes. Of course he would have known it. If he's such a powerful demon, he would have known it from the beginning.
It will never be active. Yet I'm still here, aren't I?
He asks softly. He curls his hand around my nape, bringing me closer to him until his lips hover on top of mine. All the while, his other hand is still atop my breast, slowly caressing my skin as he brushes his thumb lightly across my nipple. My breath catches in my throat as I stare into his eyes, into the turmoil I witness there.
Tell me the truth, Aemon. What am I to you?
I whisper, my voice almost breaking with emotion.
Are you playing with me? Is this just a game? A way to get back at the coven and my kind?
What if I said no?
He inquires lazily.
What if I told you that you're my entire reason for being? That you're why I wake up in the morning, every goddamn day, from the dawn of time until now? What if I told you that you belong to me in a way no woman ever belonged to a man? That I might be evil personified, but you're the only one I'll ever be good to.
He murmured.